This episode of In the Weeds includes explicit language.
That's what you're supposed to say, right?
Welcome to In the Weeds with Nicole Asquith, exploring the way culture shapes our relationship to the natural world. The B word. Some of you will know that I've been promising to deliver this episode for months now. Why has it taken me so long? Well, to explain, I will have to tell you how this episode came to be. It all started one day when my daughter Beatrice came home and asked me a question.
So I'm working finally on my B word episode. So
finally!
I feel like I need to include why we did this episode. What was the question you asked me? Do you remember the question?
I asked you, why is the B word a bad word? Because all it means is female dogs. And we love female dogs. We have a female dog living with us, Coco. She's adorable. I love female dogs. I have no idea, like, why could it ever be something bad? I would like to be called a female dog.
So there you have it. She would like to be called a female dog. Fair question coming from a dog-crazed girl, I thought. For the record, there are three out of the four of us in our household who are dog-crazed. I won't name any names. Anyway, as I thought about the question, it started to interest me too. Why is a word that is still used to mean a female dog an insult for a woman? I was curious about what the B word might tell us about our relationship with other animals and the gendering of that relationship. As I dug into the topic, I found a book called Women and Animals with an article by Joan Dunayer that pointed out that lots of, she calls it, non-human animal pejoratives are used to insult women. A partial list includes catty, shrew, dumb bunny, it's a weird one, cow, bitch, old crow, queen bee, and sow. Here's Josephine Donovan, the editor of Women and Animals, commenting on this intersection of the animal and the female.
What generally occurs when women are compared to animals is that they're demeaned or demoted or reduced to the level of animals and therefore seen as inferior, as animals are seen in a speciesist point of view.
I looked into the history of the word. The Oxford English Dictionary tells us that the modern word bitch comes from the Old English biche, I think I've got that roughly right, which probably developed from the Norse. All meaning female dog. According to an article by Claire Bailey, words for dogs were often used as insults. But the word bitch, or rather a version of the madman-esque son of a bitch, was levied at men as often as at women, as in Shakespeare's Troilus and Cressida.
Thou bitch wolf son, canst thou not hear? Feel then!
Or this passage from King Lear.
Thou art nothing but the composition of a knave, beggar, coward, pander, and the son and heir of a mongrel bitch.
That sound. According to Jeffrey Hughes' Encyclopedia of Swearing, and yes, there totally is a book called that, words for dogs were used as insults for men as well as women in the past. It seems that the sting associated with bitch has varied in intensity over its 700 years or so of use in English. But the virulent female sense of the word became dominant in the 18th century and, according to Claire Bailey, came into common use after women gained the vote in 1920, raising speculations of a backlash against gaining female power. As interesting as this dive into the history of the word was, I still had lots of questions. Why were words used for our most beloved fellow animal also our oldest and most common insults for each other? And why, as my daughter Beatrice had asked me, was a word for a female dog a bad word for girls and women? My first call was to a former colleague of mine, Eric Russell, a linguist in the Department of French and Italian at UC Davis. He teaches a class to undergraduates on profanity, or as he puts it in his syllabus, quote, the sorts of language that are often deemed inappropriate, offensive, or otherwise taboo, end quote. We started out talking about kids, my kids actually, who at the time were not quite 9 and 11. So I suddenly thought, and I've always been curious about your class,
It seems like such a great idea for a class, such a great way to connect with undergraduates. So I thought of you, and your class had actually come to mind a number of times, raising kids, because you access language a different way, obviously, yeah, that through kids, and the taboo of bad words, and also how their relationship evolves as they get older. Like Reggie's at an age now where, with his friends, like they will use those words.
Yes. He's the 11-year-old.
Yeah, he's about to turn 11. So, and he's on the younger side for his grade. So it's like all of a sudden, like that taboo is not a big enough barrier. They're flirting with the barrier.
That's interesting because it, so many things intersect, right? Like language is, of course, nothing except in its context, and its context will kind of determine so much of what is happening. And so you have a son versus a daughter, and, these things become very gendered. Certainly not intrinsically, but they become very, very gendered, and then, not just the forms, but the uses and the functionalities associated with them. What it means if, a young boy uses a certain form versus a young girl. This is kind of the fascinating and sometimes a bit maddening component of language, right? Because it's always already so many things at the same time.
So you say in the syllabus, one of the questions you ask is how and why do we assign value to language? Why is fuck or ass judged to be a swear word, but not fudge or butt, darn or hiney?
Yeah.
I love the word hiney.
Yeah. I really need to change that. I think they laugh.
Laughter's good though.
You can't see my gray hair now, but I'm the kind of person that they probably associate hiney with.
So I know. Well, it takes some... you have to have authority in front of the class to ask a question like that. But how do you speak to that question? I mean, it's an interesting question, right? Like, it's certainly a question that my kids are curious about. They're like, well, why is this word bad and that word's fine?
Well, and one of the things we do is we sort of break down, give them some terminology and give them some just stand back on language, right? So one of the first things I do with them is try to give them a sense of form versus content or semantic content. So it's a sort of signifiant, signifié, the difference between signifier and signified.
Okay, little interruption here for those of you who weren't introduced to these terms in a literary theory class in the 1980s. Eric is referring to terms borrowed from the French linguists. I'm just going to pronounce it the French way because it's easier for me. Ferdinand de Saussure. Saussure, if you prefer. The signifier is basically the word in its purest form, the sound. Bitch, in our case, or the written word, bitch, whereas the signified is the concept. Think of the difference between a physical stop sign, that would be the signifier, and what it's asking you to do, i.e. stop the car at the corner, that would be the signified. When Eric talks about form, he's also talking about the sound or the written word, the signifier, divorced from any meaning or connotation.
Mm-hmm. Which is, the Saussurean approach is a bit, but it's more than a little bit passe, frankly, but and it is a bit positivistic anyway. But but it is helpful for them to understand like their forms. So a word like fuck is a form, right? It has a phonological corpus. It has a written manifestation on the page, and then of course there are the meanings associated with that. And for a word like fuck, certainly there are many different meanings. So one is, we would say that marked as a verb, so that is, some sort of sexual act. One is an interjection, which actually has, no referential meanings, but, it's one of the ways I sort of get them to think about interjections are, what is it you scream when you hit your knee on the coffee table and you're in pain, right? So the sort of thing that you inject into otherwise reference-having language acts. And then there are lots of derivations of fuck. So, fucking, there's a case study where Bono used fucking. He said something like, if I'm remembering correctly, he got some sort of award and said, this is fucking brilliant. Mm-hmm. And it was broadcast on national television, one of the like NBC, ABC, whatever it was, and was threatened with a fine for it because the FCC said, this always refers to a lewd and lascivious sexual act. And of course, anyone who speaks English knows that he was not using it that way. He was saying this is very, 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 very brilliant.
Right.
It's a modifier of sort of extreme intensity. So we give them these ways of thinking about and describing language, and then we step into the interpretation and we say, you know, so why do you have something like ass versus hiney, let's say, you know, two different forms, but they refer to the same part of the body. So they have the same reference. And so then it's getting them to think more about meaning in a complex way. So there's denotation. It's the same denotation for both of those forms, but the connotations are slightly different, and certainly the associations are different. And it has nothing to do with that which is denoted. It has to do with the person who is doing the denoting.
In other words, much of the meaning comes from the person who is doing the talking.
And all of this is socially constructed, or is culturally constructed, right? None of this has any intrinsic reference, any intrinsic denotation, connotation, etc. So, you know, the form inherits all of this. And then getting them to think, well, what does that mean that we have the option to say ass versus hiney versus, you know, whatever, one of the other thousand ways of referring to the posterior region of your body. And it's actually, you know, kind of absolutely fascinating. So, you know, my quest with that is not at all to get them to answer the question with any definitiveness, but to be able to discuss the question.
Right.
With more, you know, a more critical approach.
Yeah, and there's not going to be a definitive answer. But
I mean, if you want the quick and dirty answer, like, why is fuck a bad word? It's because we collectively have decided that it's a bad word.
Right. When you say socially constructed, and I mean, the models of language that I've always found to be the most useful, I mean, I take it primarily from Wittgenstein, are models based on mm-hmm. use, right? How language is used.
Yeah. Yeah.
Any adult in the English language will know that the word fuck can be used so many different ways with so many different colors and connotations. Mm-hmm. I wonder, it also has something to do with the history of the use, right? So I feel like that's an interesting aspect of it, like how these things get inherited and passed along and sort of mutated over time, right?
Well, and I think you're hitting on something really important there. We often tend to historify language without really putting that historicization into a context, right? So it's not necessarily that we bear the history of forms, let's say, or expressions, but that we've inherited the, you know, our mental mapping, to take a cognitive turn on this. You know, you hear fuck, so you hear a form, in this case, it's a phonological form. There's a mental representation of that. And within nanoseconds, evokes the denotation. So let's say it's the denotation of sex, right? As well as all of the connotations and associations are drawn up with it instantaneously, if you will. Well, how did we get to those, right? Like those didn't, we weren't born with them pre-programmed in our cognition. We had to inherit them, but we didn't inherit their entire history. We inherited that which was in our environment. And there's this chain reaction of it, right? So that's where I'm cautious about thinking of history as that which is literally acting upon us now. What's acting upon us now is the residue of history, if you will,
mm-hmm.
by virtue of the present. You know, another one that is discussed ad nauseum, and I apologize for using this word, it's one of the ones that makes me cringe, but fag or faggot. And there's a whole lot of conversation around why that's a bad word and why we should avoid it. And to me, it's absolutely fascinating that people will say, it's a bad form because in the past, faggot referred to a bundle of sticks and someone who is gay or identifies as gay, what have you, you know, somehow is not perceived as normatively masculine, is therefore, you know, to be burned at the stake. And there's certainly, that's a very long history, particularly in Europe, of punishing homosexuals by burning. But there's not a lot of evidence. Well, first of all, there's not a lot of evidence for that being the historic trajectory of the form. But also, why do we need to invoke past injustices to say, you know, no one thinks of that. I don't think any, you know, North American Anglophone, when he hears or she hears the form faggot, is thinking of, you know, burning people at the stake. What is actually happening there? You know, if I were to scream that at someone that I saw, certainly I've had it screamed at me, I don't believe anyone is evoking the denotation of burning What they're saying is we perceive this person to be non-normatively masculine, and we perceive that person to be bad, and we believe ourselves to have the right to say that or write it or communicate it in one form or another. And I think that's where the historicity becomes a bit dangerous.
Mm.
It allows us to mask what's happening now.
That's interesting. I guess as somebody whose background is in literature, I'm more inclined to look at the past, or I don't know more, but like that's definitely like an easy starting point, right? To look at the etymology, for instance. But what you're saying is very interesting, because in a way it seems like you're saying both.
So lots of like, stay with faggot. I mean, not to disagree, I'm not saying that it's nothing that should be, you know, it shouldn't be investigated. I think it actually should. But if we're talking about that moment, let's say, this is something that happened to me and my husband several years ago. We were walking in a park and some person yelled out of the car window, faggot. And, you know, virtually all of my gay male friends, and actually some of my straight male friends, have said that they've experienced moments like this. So why was this offensive? Why was this perceived to be belligerent? It has nothing to do with the history of the word, at least in the first instance. It has everything to do with what it means to do that right then and there. Because forms don't have intrinsic meaning. They don't have stable meanings. And there's nothing about the form, take this one as the phonological form, because it was spoken or yelled, faggot, that is intrinsically denoting anything. I mean, it could mean a thousand different things in different contexts and different languages, that sequence of phonemes. And my perception of it and understanding of it, just for simplicity's sake, as a hostile communicative act, had nothing to do with the history, at least not the long longitudinal history of it. It had to do personally, maybe with my personal history with it, or my vicarious history of having seen it on television or been around other friends and so forth. But certainly not to do with its history that can be traced to the 16th century and so forth.
It has to do with the way that it's used right in that moment. Like, yeah, sort of like, you know, I don't know, for some reason I'm thinking of a stick. Like, you can use a stick to, if you're my daughter, you can use a stick to tell a story, or obviously you can use a stick to hurt somebody.
Yeah, you can use it to poke your brother in the eye, or, you know, whatever things that people do with sticks.
So my conversation with Eric Russell taught me to be more careful when speaking about language, but I still had questions about the B word. Next, through the intervention of an editor friend of mine, I had a chat with the comedian Adam Oliensis.
So my 11-year-old, she comes down into the kitchen, she slams a tangerine in the counter, and she says to me, "Bitch, peel my orange."
Really?
Yeah. And I say, "Sophie, we don't talk to each other that way in this family. Say, bitch, peel my orange, please." Yeah. See, I think nice. I handled that pretty well. Yeah.
I explain my dilemma to Adam.
Why is a word for a dog used for women? Why is an animal word a put down when it comes to women, and so on? So that's why I brought you, a man who's a comedian,
right,
to talk about this subject.
Right. Well, that's good, because I studied philosophy, and I have a degree in linguistic philosophy, specifically like I wrote my thesis on a philosopher, Ludwig Wittgenstein.
Oh, yeah. Who's a big fan of Wittgenstein. Oh, yeah.
Cool. Then we have a common vocabulary, or maybe. So his view of things, and one that I think is pretty good, is that it all boils down to usage.
Mm-hmm.
And that it has meaning within a context, or what he calls a language game.
Ah, the sticky wicket of language again.
So I think it's a great subject, because there are contexts in which it isn't powerful in that aggressive way,
mm-hmm, right?
Like among comedians, or like comedians, the ones that I know and I'm friends with, you can say anything and they get that you're just sort of trying it on, you're just doing loop de loops, you're just playing. But if I say it to my wife when I'm angry, it's a very different animal,
right?
And my daughters, I have older daughters, 24 and 22, they liberally use the C word.
Mm.
Among each other, between each other and among themselves, a word that I'm not allowed to use.
Right.
I mean, unless it's with comedian friends, and or unless you're Jim Jefferies, who's a comedian who's Australian. Different meaning in Australia, different usage.
What does it mean in Australia?
Well, it's used like like almost like calling someone a dumbass.
Hmm.
Although, you know, I suppose that would be sexist in some sense, that it's an insult to use a female body part. But more like the what, you know, we would use a, what are our rules here for language? I can say these words.
Oh, you can say them. Yeah, you can say them. Yeah, yeah.
Like you would call your friend a dick.
Right.
That doesn't have. It's not loaded.
Doesn't have the same edge to it.
Right.
Know.
It could almost be friendly. It could be insulting. Like, well, don't be a dick. You know.
Yeah.
But yeah, when you're raising kids, it's a very different animal than when you're drinking at a bar. There's some research I read recently about saying a swear word if you're in pain actually reduces the pain.
Yeah, I read that too. Okay. Yeah, yeah.
So, but if you make that swear word an okay word, saying the very same phonemes doesn't reduce the pain.
Right. So this sort of indirectly brings me back to the parenting piece of it. Like there's all this research now about all the good things that swearing does for you,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
It reduces pain. It's a sign of intelligence. It's a sign of fluency, like all these things. And, you know, and like you don't have to do research to know that there's something about a well-timed swear word that is like a release, you know? It's like...
Yeah.
So one of the interesting things for me about parenting is like... I don't have a big taboo around swear words.
Mm-hmm.
That said, like, I don't necessarily want my 11-year-old walking around saying fuck all the time.
Right.
But also, like, but one of the things I'm thinking too is, like, I kind of need to maintain the taboo for him. Like, I need to be the person who says, no, it's not okay to say this. So that when he's older, he'll get what he needs to out of saying it. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Like,
I completely agree.
It's a weird paradox.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. I have the same issue with my... my wife is more against cursing than I am.
Mm-hmm.
And my view of it is like, hey, I use the language colorfully in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
That's one tool in the toolbox. Don't wear out that tool. It'll lose the value that it has. So we want our kids to be part of the same culture, right? Another culture may use, or and it seems just as I probably curse more than my parents did, my kids curse more than I do. And they don't seem to know when not to. To me, you know, like Shakespeare says, suit the gesture to the word and the word to the gesture. And it'd be nice if they would embrace our culture and have the same view of when is a good time to use those tools for this purpose and when not. But every generation probably has to sort of strike out on their own and change that.
Yes.
And establish their own boundaries.
Yeah. As you heard, my son now says, okay, boomer, to pretty much everyone.
Oh, isn't that a pleasure?
It's just a joy. But at least, like, you know, it's not ageist, really, because as far as he hasn't quite wrapped his head around what the baby boom generation actually.
But getting back to the matter at hand.
You know, I feel like I've now, having read a bunch of stuff and talked to a bunch of people, I feel like I've approached this word from so many different directions. And I think at the end of the day, I can't totally get over the sexism that it's not about the word itself, right? Because like you said, it's like about the language game and how it gets used. But I think that, I don't know, the charge is still there at the end of the day in certain contexts, right? Like the word cannot be completely divorced from that. And I don't know. I'm just curious about that. Why that's the case with that?
I don't know. You're taking me back. When I was a kid, and I called my older sister a bitch, she got really mad, and she was really good at like saying, "I don't care," right? That taking that first step of disconnecting and saying what you're doing doesn't matter to me. But that one got through, and I never knew why, because that's not true. My sisters would call each other that, but when I called her that, it was, you know, the shit got real. And my daughters call each other that, and it doesn't, they don't, I don't know. My son calls my daughters that, and it doesn't have the charge for them.
Mm.
So I think that's generational.
I have a theory, which is pretty simple, which is sexism exists. Because I think, like, you boil it down. You know, you can talk about where the word comes from, you know, what it means. And so, like, you boil the word down, the one thing that is always identified with it in some way is female, right? Like, I mean, you can use it for a man, obviously, but like, and so I feel like the gendered aspect of it means that it's going to have a charge in certain situations because the implication is there that, like, because you're a woman that you're being called that. You know what I'm saying? Like, yeah, so, yeah, yeah. I don't know. Maybe I'm oversimplifying.
Maybe that charge is part of why a comic calling a man a bitch is funny. Mm-hmm. It's still funny, even though it's hack at this point.
Yeah.
Right? Because there is that underlying charge in it. As you were talking, I was thinking, gee, I wonder why women feel that way, because there are no words about gender that I would feel that way about. And maybe that goes back to, it's because there is sexism. And it's this, and I'm Jewish. If someone called me a dirty man, I wouldn't take. But if somebody called me a dirty Jew, it would have that charge because I haven't really experienced that in my life. But it's in my cultural memory and in my cultural training to say, hey, that's the line, because calling someone that has a history that is really full of oppression, a recent history.
It's a put down that is. Right. Marked with that in particular, like my husband talks about a Richard Pryor routine in which he's talking about the N-word and how two men are having a confrontation and they're fighting it out, you know, verbally, and it's a fight between two men. It's like it's an equal fight, but then one person brings that word out, and it changes the whole thing, right? It's no longer the same thing. It's like you've put that person in a box that means this isn't an equal fight anymore.
Right. And I mean, I don't think you're as old as I am, but you're more in my generation than my daughters are. And for them, my 24, 22 years old, I don't think they take it that way. I could be wrong. I should call them.
Yeah, maybe not.
But I don't think they take it the same way my wife does. And maybe because they're growing up sort of the next layer away from that kind of pervasive sexism. It's still there, but it's less than it was.
Yeah, that's
so maybe the extent to which the B word doesn't have that is the extent that charge is the extent to which we're making progress.
Yeah, well, that sounds good.
So far I had interviewed two guys about the B word. It was time to talk to one of my bitches, one of my female friends. Who else but my friend Jen, who was my BFF in high school and who, along with my dad, was the most formative person in my life when it came to swear words. Also, Jen loves animals. She has four cats, a dog, and a horse. And since Bee's dream had come true and we had adopted a puppy, Jen and I liked to swap dog stories, too. We talked over the phone while we were both out for a walk.
All right, so do you have anything interesting to say about the word?
I do.
I have my comment.
I do.
Okay, tell me.
I'm also walking uphill, so bear with me.
Okay.
And kind of phlegmy, so forgive me, but I guess it's who I am now, right now. I looked up the word bitch. You filled me in on this a little bit before about be asking about it, and I think it is a great question, of course. But my favorite thing about when I looked up bitch last night in the dictionary is that the first definition is the mother of a dog, wolf, fox, or otter. I like the otter part, especially, but really, and I think there are others too, but more the things that are affiliated with the canines, which I think I'm going to stop walking uphill. You know, there are protectors. Their relationship of dogs in particular is this relinquishment of the wild for the sake of it's kind of like a codependent relationship. Just in the sense that I believe they evolved to distinguish themselves from wolves for food. You know, for food and protection, for human protection, and kind of garbage, composting, all that stuff, and for humans to get protection and for them to get food. So, but implicit in all of that is this just tone of protectiveness. And when I looked at a bunch of different sources in the dictionary, there was more of an emphasis on human, female human behavior of aggression and protection. And then the verb is, it seems like where it takes a turn, like where it just seems complaining, which is a different thing to be bitching about something. So I feel like that's the real, that's where I take a front. Because there's this way that, you know, a female dog has a totally different flavor of aggression from a male dog, and in protecting her litter. And I assume the same is true for wilder animals.
Yeah.
And I don't, I suppose that is, that's just kind of part of misogyny, that culture would make that bad, to be, you know, have a bad flavor or something to, or bad connotation to be a protective female, like protective of your tribe or if you're whatever. But when I think of it, like, in a slangy way, it just seems mean, period, and sometimes reactive. And I guess that is, that's kind of built in with the aggression of the mom dog, as I think of it.
That's interesting. So so you think of it as having a basis in actual female canine behavior.
I do, and I think like it's just distorted.
And now it's just like a denigration of women.
Of women, yeah.
Yeah.
And anything animal about women is degraded, right? Like,
right.
And I mean, in sort of, I don't even know how to name it with culture, because it's some parts of culture that would degrade nursing or female smells, whatever, you know, whatever
right.
we're taught
anything
to mask or hide.
Our animal
our biology. Exactly.
And women, of course, are tend to be associated more with that aspect of people in general.
Yep. Yeah. And then there's this kind of, another way I think of bitchy is like kind of mean, kind of vitriolic gay men, like mean queens, you know, being like, that is another distortion of female as that is like, you know, it has its own place, but it is a distortion of the, a female essence, I think. And it can be great and funny, but it's one, it's funny. It's odd that we think of it like that. It's interesting, at least.
Yeah.
And then also think about the sound of the word bitch and like, because the way they, I can't think of what they call it in the dictionary where they spell it phonetically, but it's lowercase b, lowercase I, capital C, capital H, and the C and the H look gigantic compared to the little letters. And it looked like, bitch! You know? And that sounds sharp and like barbed wire, kind of.
Yeah,
speaking of which, I've got Gloria and Trio, two female dogs, and we're talking about the word bitch for a podcast. Mwah, happy day. Mwah! My crazy dog, who sometimes acts like a little bitch, is she marks everything like a male dog. She lifts her leg everywhere.
Really?
It's so funny. Yeah.
That's
funny.
Sorry, Coco's mad at me right now because I've abandoned her.
Sorry, Coco.
Hey,
the word almost seems like lines is how I hear it, the shape of it in my head, and words like itch and what else is there? Bitch, itch, witch. They all have that kind of aggravating sound to them too.
Yeah, which is like it gives it this sort of punch.
I had one remaining question. What about female dogs?
Female dog.
Jen had implied that there was something bitchy about bitches, but was that actually true, or was our sense of gender overdetermined in some way? I decided I need to talk to someone who knew more about dogs, so I reached out to Jamie Ionello, a dog trainer who works at For the Love of Dogs, a dog rescue in Ossining, New York. I started out by asking her what she associates with the word.
When I hear bitch, I do not think dog first.
Okay. And then I asked her the question that was nagging me. Was there actually a noticeable difference between female and male dogs?
Yeah, like I said, I get that question a lot. offhand, I'm like, nah, you know, I see a lot of different breeds with a lot of different temperaments. So I don't make any assumptions. And because sometimes assumptions can, in your mind, can affect your behavior and the way you're being around that dog. And that in turn can affect the way the dog is going to be around you. So anyway, with male and female, I haven't, because my brain doesn't go into like labeling in that way, but I haven't really seen anything obvious. But if I really think about it, I could definitely say that overall, I find male dogs just be a little bit more easygoing, a little bit more kind of let things roll off, kind of like men compared to women who can be a little bit more, you know, sometimes looking for the drama. You know, sometimes they get caught, like, you know, women, I feel like sometimes can get caught up in things, emotions. I feel like for like female dogs, I have seen them be a little bit more feisty and bold in their behavior, you know, where a male dog with similar traits might be a little bit more easygoing about it, more matter of fact.
Feisty? What are you saying? Emotional? Nah. Well, I hope you enjoyed this meandering path that we took in response to my daughter's question. The question of why the B word is a bad word and what that means is difficult to answer because it opens up the thornier question of how language works. A side question that is also worth dwelling on is how our language shapes our relationship to other animals, as in the case of the female dog. In closing, I want to refer you to a chapter of one of my favorite books, a book you might be familiar with called Braiding Sweetgrass by Robin Wall Kimmerer. She has a chapter in it called Learning the Grammar of Animacy, in which she talks about how, in the language of her ancestors, Potawatomi, nouns and verbs are marked as either animate or inanimate. In other words, you speak one way of a living being and a different way of a non-living thing. In Potawatomi, Kimmerer tells us, beingness is a tribute not only to humans, but also to plants and animals, even to rocks, mountains, water, fire, and places. It's a fascinating reflection on how language can shape our relationship to the natural world. So I offer you that as a parting thought and maybe something we can pick up in another episode. Thank you to my friend and former colleague Eric Russell, to Adam Oliensis and Adam Bernier, who recorded my interview with Adam O, to Josephine Donovan for breaking down the feminist take on bitch for me, to Stephanie Kovacs-Cohen and Stacey Bone Gleason from ARC Stages, who kindly read the Shakespeare parts, to my dear friend Jennifer Lynch, and to Jamie Ionello, and finally, to Bee and my dear little bitch Coco. Next time, car ads. What is the fantasy of off-roading in nature all about?